Iceland's booming tourism trade and what Maine might learn from this island nation. We're going to talk about tourism on today's show, but first we must acknowledge Iceland's huge game last week against powerhouse Argentina in the World Cup. I'm Jennifer Rooks, coming to you from Iceland, a nation of just over 300,000 people, and home to a soccer team that has become the darling of the soccer, or should I say, football world. Tomorrow, Iceland takes on Nigeria, and you can bet most of these 300,000+ people on this island will be tuned into the game. What the financial impact the World Cup team and its success has on the country isn't known. But we do know tourism makes up a significant part of Iceland's economy. Today, we'll discuss what Maine can learn from Iceland's successful tourism industry. But first, this news update. From the Roof Studios in Reykjavik, Iceland, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. In the studio with me, a group of Mainers who are friends of Maine Public. Welcome. Iceland may be about 4,000 miles from Maine, but this country and our state have a lot in common. We both have economies that historically relied on fishing, farming, and trade, and now both very much rely on tourism. In both places, a small population punches above its weight when it comes to tourism. Maine's population of 1.2 million people welcomed more than 36 million tourists last year, most of whom arrive by car. Iceland's tiny population of 348,000 people welcomed 2.2 million tourists. Almost all of those arrived by plane. In both cases, those numbers were a record. So we share the challenges of supporting and sustaining a healthy tourism industry, while also looking out for our own citizens' well-being, our infrastructure, and our environment. What can we learn from each other? Well, joining me here in the studios of Roof in just a minute, three people who are working very hard on this issue. But first, we're going to talk about sports. And we are here with, and I'm going to have him introduce himself because I can't say his name.
Haukur Harðarson.
And what is your role here?
These days, I'm hosting the World Cup pre- and post-match shows here at Roof because we have the World Cup in football, as we say here in this part of the world, or soccer, as you say, in Maine and the rest of the U.S., And it's going on in Russia right now. Iceland is competing. We have a team there for the first time, and it's by far the tiniest population ever to compete at the World Cup.
I know, the tiniest ever and the first time for Iceland. The first match was a tie with Argentina. Put that into context. How big of a deal was that, and why is a tie such a big deal?
It's almost if I was playing one-on-one basketball with LeBron James, and we just call it evens. And it's just unbelievable, really. Football has always been really popular and the most popular sport here in Iceland. However, Argentina is football is almost not almost. It's religion over there. It's just they live and breathe football, and they have the best player, or at least one of the two best players on the planet right now, in Lionel Messi. So it's just absolutely astonishing accomplishment to get a draw in our very first appearance at the World Cup. They have done it so many times. They're 2 times world champions. And it was just, I was lucky enough to be there a few days back in Moscow.
I was going to ask and, you, yes. You were at the match. What was it like?
Oh, it was just so surreal. I had to pinch me in the arm a couple of times, for real. As I walked into the stadium on match day, I just looked up and saw 40,000 Argentinians. And they were so loud, you wouldn't believe it. Because they're not doing this for the first time, let me tell you. And then I looked up and saw about 5,000 Icelanders as well, and they were singing and cheering and like perfect unity and harmony, and it was just goosebumps all over. But I think all of us were so nervous for the game because Icelanders are somewhat, in general, kind of pessimistic. But it's just in our nature because we've always had to fight for our like almost right to survive. But that was the case there. And then the match went on and it ended so good for us. And everyone was really relieved. But it's only 1 point we get from this. And we have Nigeria coming up and we also have to do good there.
What is so special about this Icelandic team?
This is a a golden generation for sure here in Iceland. There are players born maybe between 1988 and 1990 that build up the core of the team, and they are just really good players. They're good friends, and it always gets a lot of attention when people realize that our coach is now a part-time dentist, and our goalkeeper, he was the director of the biggest Coca-Cola ad before the World Cup. So, and he's in the goal, like in at the World Cup, and that's kind of unique. We fly with the team in the same plane, and that's unheard of when we talk to our colleagues. And things like this, this is everything so small. It's a tightly knit group, and we just use what could be a big weakness to our strengths.
All right, so a lot of people in Maine are following Iceland, sort of adopted Iceland as their team.
Thank you.
what ought to we be looking for in the Nigeria match?
Absolutely, it's going to be more of a battle, because maybe more similar teams when you look at their status, although Nigeria have a lot of players from the English Premier League and they have been to the World Cups many times before. But I think Iceland is going to have the possession of the ball a little bit more, so it might be a tricky game to, one of the teams has to take over the game, and if it's going to be Iceland, we have to just be able to do just that and take advantage of it and hopefully get in a goal or two and keep our clean sheet again, for the first time in this tournament.
You guys have any questions for him before we let him go?
First game for the game.
2-1 Iceland.
2-1 Iceland. Terrific. Well, thanks so much for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
So now we're going to talk about tourism. And before we do so, I'm going to have all three guests introduce themselves again with the Icelandic names. Conrad, tell us your full name and what you do here in Iceland.
Yeah, my name is Conrad Gudjonsson. I'm the chief economist of the Iceland Chamber of Commerce.
Thank you so much for being here. Maggie, tell us your full name.
Well, my name is Margrét Gauja Magnúsdóttir. My guiding name is Maggie. Very easy and understandable.
Okay, and you are a guide and have also served in government, correct?
Yes, I left office the 15th of June. That was my last day as an elected member of the town council of Hafnarfjörður.
Okay, and I think I could probably hear your name. Oscar Avila is with the U.S. Embassy.
Correct, I'm an American here in Iceland working for the U.S. Embassy.
Okay, well, now we'll go to some questions. Conrad, what has the rise in tourism meant for the Icelandic economy? I know 10 years ago, Iceland was in real trouble, wasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. We saw banking crises that are basically unprecedented. Well, in most parts of the world, the combined bankruptcy of the three big banks here, I think it was bigger than Enron or close to that. So it's quite large for such a small country. But what tourism has done is that I would say, sort of from estimates and just looking at the big picture, the tourism is accountable for half the recovery or not even more since then. Mm. And since then, Iceland has bounced back. We've seen a massive drop in unemployment. We've seen influx of foreign workers because workers are needed, because the unemployment is so low. We've seen incomes rise. So overall, it's been, I would say, a blessing given from the situation we were in 2010 or so.
Maggie, was the boom in tourism the result of strategic thinking, or was there a plan, or was it just luck?
I think that the government at that time, in 2009 and 10, had to kind of rethink a plan to produce jobs. And because of the value of the krona at that time was so low, so people could actually afford to come to Iceland. So they launched this big international campaign called Inspired by Iceland. And it was working, actually. You know, you could feel, you know, the impact of it. We were seeing more people wearing Gore-Tex jackets in downtown Reykjavik. And then...
Is that a symbol of somebody from somewhere else?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Especially it has very bright colors.
I see.
And then, but then...
So the government, it was the government that had this plan inspired by Iceland.
Yes.
And it was a public relations command.
Yes.
And Icelandic Air was a part of this, correct?
Yes.
Where people would get a good deal on their plane flight if they stopped in Iceland.
Yes. And also just to draw people into Iceland. And we were, you know, using the Northern Lights and using all the aspects that we had and promoting nature all over the world. And then Eyjafjallajökull went off, or as you probably call it, the E15 or the volcano, went off in March of 2010. And just to be frank, we were just going, now nobody wants to come to Iceland. But it was the best PR stunt this island could have ever given to us, I think, because we were on the news all over the world, showing the dramatic nature. And but after that, it has been just increasing. About 30% a year from that point?
We've seen annual growth of 23-24% on average since 2010. Yeah. So just to give a perspective, number of Americans visiting Iceland has grown by a factor of 14 since 2009. From 40-ish thousand to close to 600,000.
Mari, I'd like you to introduce yourself and join the conversation. We're joined. Mari, what's your last name?
So my name is Maria Björk Gunnarsdóttir, and I come from Promote Iceland. We're responsible for the Inspired by Iceland campaign.
Oh, I'm terrific. And does that continue, or is it done now?
No, it continues. It's important to continue marketing, but it's conducted differently. So soon after the Inspired by Iceland campaign, we created another campaign that's ongoing. It's called Iceland All Year Round. And the emphasis is on sort of spreading tourists, if you could say that. So introducing other parts of Iceland than the southwestern corner, and also travels off the sort of high season, so winter travels and spring and autumn as well.
You know, that's really important to the people promoting tourism in Maine as well, is trying to make it not just a summer destination. Have you had luck, and is there any advice you can give to Maine and other places that have real winter?
It has definitely worked. We've seen great increase in tourism in the sort of shoulder season and off seasons. So that's really important for the Icelandic economy and sort of all infrastructure and tourism, because it's hard if it's just a seasonal business. Advice is, what was challenging to begin with was that, you know, just basic things. We were lacking images of tourism in winter, and so it's important to have content and share the message continually.
Oscar, bringing you into the conversation, talk about give us a mini history lesson about Iceland's relationship to the United States. I think a lot of people in the U.S. don't know that until very recently there was a U.S. Navy presence here.
Right. That is a big part of our history here, is our security relationship. We had a base here until 2006. But we're very proud that we were the first country to recognize Iceland as a country in 1944. And our relationship goes back a long way, and it's very broad. So these days it focuses on economic issues, security, and things like people-to-people relationships. I think sort of the guiding philosophy of diplomacy is that if countries get to know each other, the relations will improve. And so the fact that we have people from Maine who are here, or people coming from America every year, is good for our relationship. And generally, we're on a very positive footing.
And the relationship now is as strong as ever, would you say?
I would say absolutely. We have so much in common. We're more linked than ever before. We have, of course, all the air routes and all the tourists coming here as well.
Conrad, many people in Maine are familiar with the Eimskip containers on the Portland waterfront. We have some nods in our audience as you say that. What makes the economic relationship with the United States distinctive? Are we one of Iceland's biggest trading partners? Is that changing?
Yes, you are not only one of the biggest, you are the biggest and by far the biggest trading partner.
Really? Bigger than the European countries, the other Scandinavian countries?
Bigger than the single European countries, yes, definitely. But just to give a perspective, the US accounts for 16% of all Iceland's imports and exports, goods and services, all trade. The next country behind is 10%, and that's the UK. So economically, the US is arguably by far the most important country for Iceland, definitely.
And is the majority of that coming through those IMSKIP containers?
A lot of it, yes. But the primary reason, though, for that is the tourism, because American tourists account for close to 30% of all tourists coming into Iceland. And that's a big part of the sort of often untold story explaining the tourism boom in Iceland. And that's the rise in transatlantic flight, which we've seen the Icelandic airlines doing very well. And that has opened up new air routes and brought in passengers from places that wouldn't have come otherwise. So that's an important factor as well. But still, again, the goods trades, which coming with those containers is strong as ever, I think.
All right. Well, we do have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about tourism, the similarities between Maine and Iceland, and what we can learn from each other. We'll be right back.
You make Maine calling possible, as do Camden National Wealth Management, providing comprehensive financial advice to clients throughout Maine, New England, and beyond. CamdenNational.com. And Monhegan Museum of Art and History, celebrating 50 years with an exhibition of 70 artists, including Rockwell Kent. More at MonheganMuseum.org. You're listening to a special broadcast of Maine Calling from Iceland on Maine Public Radio. The program was pre-recorded, so no calls are being taken at this time. You can always find Maine Calling online at mainepublic.org.
The House could vote on two immigration bills, but neither one appears likely to pass. Republicans are split, and Democrats are angry over family separation.
We will not be cowed by taking little children hostage and then being demanded to vote for things that we think are harmful to the American people.
I'm Audie Cornish. What's next for immigration legislation this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered every weekday afternoon from 4 to 6:30. Here on Maine Public Radio.
President Trump's base largely supported his policy of separating children from migrant families at the border. But now the president is putting a stop to that.
I signed an executive order. We're going to keep families together, but the border is going to be just as tough as it's been.
We'll examine how President Trump's base is responding to his new policy. That's on the next Morning Edition.
Start your day with Morning Edition every weekday morning at 6 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. You're listening to a special Maine Calling recorded in Iceland. And now, back to Jennifer in Iceland, discussing tourism.
Welcome back to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, broadcasting from the RUV studios in Reykjavik, Iceland. We're here talking about tourism. It is Iceland's biggest part of its economy, as the same as Maine. We both are beautiful places to visit. We both are places with a history of farming and fishing, but places that are really in the midst of real challenges and real opportunities because of the changing economy. We were talking before about some of the links between Maine and the U.S., but I want to get back to tourism. Maggie, let's talk about the challenges. Do you think there's a tipping point in which Iceland won't be able to handle more tourists?
No, I don't think there's a tipping point. We are always talking about now it's the tipping point. And, you know, like there now we've had enough, but I think we have plenty of room, you know, to receive tourists in Iceland. But we have to focus on our infrastructure. We have to put money and to servicing people in the right places. We are suffering from severe growing pains. in tourism, especially in the interior of the country. There are municipalities, small municipalities, especially like on the south coast and in other places, that are suffering because of tourism, even though they're economically probably blooming at the moment, but they are suffering. I lived in Höfn for 2 years, which is on the south, no, east part of the country. And you could feel the intent of the people there growing against tourism because their quality of life was going down because it's such a small town, so many people. And, you know, you could feel the job applications and teachers leaving schools to become guides, you know, all these little problems that add up into frustration. So, but we can receive more, but we have to start focusing a lot more on infrastructure and to make sure not that only the people that come visit us are happy and enjoying our country, because it is a beautiful place. Mm. And it's, for me, I'm also a teacher. I love being a guide because I look at Iceland as my classroom. And but we have to rethink the focus and also security. We need to keep our guests safe.
All right. You know, that's, I think, some of the issues raised are issues in many places where tourism is a big part of the economy, that the locals have a love-hate relationship.
Yes.
With the tourists. They love the money and the excitement they bring, but also feel pressure from it. And Maria, this is your story, that you were a teacher and went into the tourism industry. What has this sort of meant on more of a macro level? Are we seeing a shift in which now there aren't enough teachers in Iceland?
I think we're definitely seeing that, but there are many factors other than tourism that are involved in that story.
I read also that 10% of emergency room visits are tourists. So now Iceland is facing having to bring, you know, more doctors and nurses into the hospitals.
Yes, that's true. And this is part of, you know, we have more people in the country. So obviously we need better infrastructure and service. So it's important to step up the game there, definitely.
Okay.
But we're also seeing sort of positive aspects. We're seeing surveys among local people. They say that Icelanders, they're appreciating their sort of backyard even better than before because they're seeing all these visitors that are coming just for that. So they are sort of enjoying Iceland more.
It's funny you say that. I was wondering about that. It seems to me that everyone I've met in the little bit of time I've been here has felt very proud of their country and very proud to tell me about their country. Have people always felt this way, or do they feel that way more so now that they're kind of seeing their own country through somebody else's eyes?
I think it helps, you know, having the guest's eye sort of to tell us that, you know, it's really, it's something different. We have great nature and an easy access to many natural phenomena, basically, and that's great.
We also tied with Argentina 1-1. That's why we are so proud these days.
If I could add from just the American embassy point of view, absolutely. Because Americans are this largest single source of tourism, I think we feel a responsibility to continue to be a positive story and focus on some of the strains that are caused by tourism. So we actually organized a group, we being the embassy, of tourism officials from Iceland to go to the United States last year. And one of the places they went was Acadia National Park, a place with, I think, 5,000 or 6,000 people in Bar Harbor, which is inundated by tourists on a seasonal basis, to see how the road system works, to see how the infrastructure works, to see if there are any lessons that they can learn here in Iceland to help keep tourism sustainable and, you know, to the benefit of the community. So we're trying to do what we can to share knowledge both ways and keep this a positive story.
All right. Conrad, what are some of the other infrastructure challenges that are brought upon by 2.2 million tourists?
To pinpoint one thing, I would say the road system.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, that's sort of the biggest infrastructural challenge, single infrastructural challenge, because what happened after the crisis is that we saw cuts in road maintenance and construction. And then you have this tourism boom, you have this boom of the economy. So there's a lot more, basically there's more, a lot more cars on the roads and not enough money being put into maintaining them. So I would say that's the main challenge. And also it's even more of a challenge for Iceland because it's so densely, sparsely populated. I mean, there's hardly anyone lives here apart from this part of the country. So I mean, it's.
And I want you to expand on that a little bit, because this is really interesting. When you say this part of the country, we're sitting in a radio studio in Reykjavik right now.
Yes.
Reykjavik is the largest city in Iceland. How many people live in Iceland, and how many people live in the greater Reykjavik area?
So there are about 350,000 living in whole of Iceland, and just in greater Reykjavik, there are about 200,000.
65% of 65% all of us live here in the greater
and
Reykjavik
then
area.
If you add on top of that towns and villages that are maybe 1 hour drive from Reykjavik, then you get close to 70% or 80% of the whole population. So basically everyone lives on this tiny corner of the country. So,
and but tourists want to see the whole thing.
Of course.
Yes, yes. And that's also been part of the challenges that sort of infrastructurally is that because we have the airport here, we have all the hotels and the restaurants and all of that here. That's why it's been quite a challenge to bring tourists to other parts of the countries as well. And now with Iceland becoming a bit more expensive with the strong appreciation of the Icelandic krona, that's even more of a challenge for people to bring people to the other side of the country.
That makes a lot of sense. We're going to take another quick break, and when we come back, we're going to take questions from the audience. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as do Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco, and Mercy Hospital, celebrating 100 years in Greater Portland, partnering with the community to deliver the next century of care. MercyHospital.org. You're listening to a special broadcast of Maine Calling from Iceland on Maine Public Radio. The program was pre-recorded, so no calls are being taken at this time. You can always find Maine Calling online at mainepublic.org.
Lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender history, as told by the people who were there, like this witness to Moscow's first Pride Parade.
We have to change the mentality, and I was really proud to be part of this.
Listen for a special edition of Witness for Pride Month from the BBC.
Join us for that BBC documentary coming up in about 20 minutes after Maine Calling at 2 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Vanity Fair writer Emily Jane Fox, who spent the past year investigating Ivanka Trump and her siblings. Her book, Born Trump, Inside America's First Family, includes intimate portraits of Trump's older children who didn't expect their father to win the 2016 election. Join us.
Fresh Air is tonight at 7 o'clock, here on listener-supported Maine Public Radio. You're listening to a special Maine Calling recorded in Iceland. And now, more of that episode, taped earlier today from the studios of Rúv in Reykjavik.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and we are broadcasting today from Iceland. We've been talking about the similarities between Maine and Iceland, and especially when it comes to tourism, some of the challenges we both face and what we can learn from each other. We're going to go to questions from our audience right now. Does anyone in the audience have a question? And if you would please say your name and before you ask the question.
I'm Felicia Wiswell from Arlington, Maine. Speaking about the tourism for year-round and how Maine is also working on tourism for year-round, I'm wondering about winter As we were traveling around this week, I noticed there were snowmobile signs, but I didn't see anything about skiing, downhill skiing especially. You have these beautiful mountains. Are you taking advantage of them?
Well, ironically, skiing is not that popular in Iceland.
We go to Austria for skiing.
We go to Austria and Italy. But I think the main reason probably for that is that it needs obviously a lot of infrastructure in some cases. And then the weather is not very good often for it. And sometimes we're simply lacking snow. The weather is so unpredictable. Like, it's not like that, oh, the snow comes in October, then it stays to March, April. It comes and goes maybe 10 times. So it's so, the weather is so volatile. I think that partly explained maybe.
Yeah, and also, well, we have a good skiing resort up north. So people who are into skiing, they go a lot up to north of Akureyri because they have a completely kind of a different weather in winter than we do here on the south coast. So because I've been so fortunate, we've been guiding these people and we have been on the south coast. So that's probably, but if you would go in north in the wintertime, you would see a whole different nature and snow.
Yeah. Any other questions? Go ahead. Say your name first, please.
My name is Catherine Olmsted. I live in Caribou, Maine. And I have a question about natural resources. How do you balance the need to attract tourists without sacrificing the natural resources and the beauty that they are coming to see?
Well, that is actually a very good question. I think I can answer that. We are not. Unfortunately, for example, the government had to close down some places this spring. For example, Smoky Valley was closed. If you went up to Skógafoss and did the stairs up and there above, it was closed. And we have now been closing down places, especially this spring, because the nature was hurting. And that's our fault. It's because we're not putting enough money into our national parks. We are not qualified enough to make good walking paths that makes people stay on the walking paths. And then the walking paths are all full of mud. So people start walking out of the walking paths and the wound starts growing and growing and growing. And so it's been tough, and especially in Iceland in springtime when the frozen ground starts to thaw. You probably have this problem in Maine also. Yes. You know, it starts getting bitumen muddy. And we are experiencing this winter tourism for the first time. And now people are hiking in Iceland in these beautiful places in wintertime. So we are trying to figure this out. We are in a collaboration with other countries and have a program within the European Union. And hopefully we can learn from your national parks in the United States. And so there is a lot of infrastructure that has to take place to protect our nature. And we need to do more research. Mm-hmm. We need to do more research and knowledge nature-wise and also the social impact of tourism in Iceland.
Maggie, we call spring mud season in Maine.
Yeah, so, well, we have a mud season. Yeah. Yes, and now we have tourists walking in the mud. So it's...
And Oscar, you were nodding as she talked. She's talking about the same challenges we face in Acadia National Park and other national parks.
Absolutely. And it's funny and interesting you mentioned the National Park Service. We're about to launch a partnership between our National Park Service and their equivalent here in Iceland. It's going to take many forms, and it could include things like ranger training, exchanges, sort of high-level exchange as well, even things like just basic infrastructure development. So I think there is an opportunity to, again, share our experiences. We've had our own growing pains, and our national parks are very popular, as you know. So yes, we're always happy to try to facilitate that. It's important.
All right.
It is very important.
Do we have any other questions from the audience?
Yes, John Wasileski, Yarmouth, Maine. I have a question for the economist from Iceland. Sir, the race to the Arctic is presenting many challenges and opportunities for countries that border the Arctic Circle, and obviously you're one of them. What challenges and opportunities does this race to the Arctic present for Icelandic economy as well as tourism?
Well, that's a very big but very good question. I'm actually, well, it was just yesterday trying to think this through, and I think it's still a bit early days to tell exactly what the threats and opportunities are. Well, the opportunities are enormous if you're going to see more trade going through this part of the world, like through the Arctic, for instance, or if they're going to be exploiting some natural resources there. But then another side of that coin is that there are some concerns that there is too much of environmental risk for that. So, I mean, it's just something we have to see. And maybe Oscar is more involved in that. But I know that the Icelandic Foreign Service, they are keeping a close eye on that. They're following up on what China is doing with their sort of North Arctic Silk Road plans. And yeah, so, I mean, we just have to see. But I think generally Icelanders are excited, but they're also, you know, they take everything regarding this with a bit of a grain of salt as well. So we just have to see, I guess.
I met a man yesterday, Oscar, a driver, who said that there's talk of the U.S. coming back to that naval base. Is that just speculation, or is that based on something?
I would say it's even lower than speculation. It's not true. But it is something that comes up often, so we always appreciate the opportunity to sort of, you know, rebut that. We do work very closely with Iceland. We're both part of NATO. The base that exists now is a NATO facility, and it's the Icelandic Coast Guard that operates it. So we do work very closely, even though Iceland does not have a military. But as far as the U.S. coming back to operate and run the base, that is not happening. This is the model that is working now, and we continue to cooperate with Iceland in that sense.
I want to ask a question about tourism. In Maine, there's a really big issue every summer with finding enough workers to work in the hotels and restaurants that are seasonal. And we have a visa program in the U.S. And this year, apparently, there are enough visas, but last year there were not. Maggie, what do you do here in Iceland? How do you staff all of these hotels and restaurants and other tourism related fields that, you know, 348,000 people is not enough when other people have other jobs too?
I think it's as much people as the Amish in the States.
So what does Iceland do? Is there a visa program for people from other countries to come work here, or can Europeans just come here without a visa?
I think Europeans can come here without a visa. And we have, the only reason we are growing as a nation is because of immigration. We stopped having kids, but thank God that people are still want to move to Iceland and live here. So we are dependent on immigration, yes, very so much in tourism.
And just to add on that, Iceland is part of the EEA, which is basically the free market of the European Union. We're not part of the European Union, but we are part of the free market. Mm-hmm. And that means that workers from any other EU country, and also Norway, they can come here to work. And that has had basically has solved this issue, but also created new, since there we have housing shortage, et cetera. But that's a different story.
Conrad, what are the numbers? How many immigrants are coming to, how many people are coming here permanently? How many are coming here temporarily? Do we know?
Temporarily, it's hard to tell, but sort of just to, I don't have the exact number. I think close to 10% of the population, a bit more maybe, is immigrants. But there's been a massive rise in the last few years, and last year we saw the biggest population increase ever, both in absolute numbers and percentage-wise, we've ever seen in Iceland.
And how is that going over? Are people in Iceland welcoming of the immigrants?
People are welcoming, even though it has to create a challenging, which I believe is a good thing, because people know what it brings to the community and the economy, although that it brings the biggest housing shortage we've ever seen, which I would say, sort of looking back and seeing what's happening in other parts of the world, I would say that's almost call it a tremendous achievement that is not, that Icelanders are generally quite positive to immigrants.
We had elections for the municipalities about a month ago, and I follow up on that very closely for obvious reasons. And what I thought was very surprisingly, there was no discussion in any municipality as the immigration as like a problem that had to be solved, or, you know, an issue. It was just like, nope, and in being in an immigration boom, but there was no discussion about it, which I think is good. So, you know, silence means it's a good thing. People are not considering it a problem.
So you can be proud of your country and also welcome immigrants.
Yes.
Because Icelanders are very proud.
And what about immigrants that don't speak your impossible language well?
We have a great understanding.
I mean, it's fine.
We don't get it ourselves.
Most of them don't speak it anyways until maybe after a few years. So that's fine.
That's fine. Do we have another question from the audience? Go ahead.
Carolyn Murray from Falmouth, Maine. I've been impressed with the number of people that you have to come and visit, and I wondered where Icelanders like to go and visit, hopefully Maine.
Well, weather is stability in weather, sun, beach, and cheap beer, we are there.
Well, that's Maine.
That's basically it.
That's basically it.
Or the World Cup, where I'm going in just an hour. So.
Are you really? Aren't you lucky? And how did you get a ticket?
It was actually quite easy, but getting the flight, that was a tricky part.
Well, I'll ask you another economist question, because I know economists like numbers. I read that 10% of Iceland is in Russia right now? Is that accurate?
I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. I would say maybe 1% to 2%. However, I think at the Euros, European
Championship. In
France,
2 years ago.
Yeah. Then I would say overall, 10% of the population were at some time following the team, or even more.
Yeah, and I think the reason there's not the 10% of the country going to Russia right now, because we did so good in the European Cup 2 years ago, and we just, people who were there, they had to stay and, you know, prolong their trip, and they're probably just still paying the visa bills.
They spent their money. Yeah. Oscar, you grew up in Kansas, serving in the embassy here in Iceland. Have you caught World Cup fever?
You can't not catch World Cup fever here, especially because our esteemed 11 did not make it to the World Cup from the United States. So we've all adopted Iceland as our team, no doubt about it.
So characterize for the U.S. audience, who, if you're from Kansas, you know, doesn't quite get it. Characterize what they need to know, what they need to get about this.
About the World Cup.
Yeah, and about Iceland being in the World Cup.
Well, I think, yeah, just the size of the country and the achievement. And it really is just the theme that I see in Iceland is it is a small country, but its impact around the world is tremendous, be it music, film, and now sports. It is a country that you can kind of fall in love with. And those of you who are here will understand. And so just how I think the source of pride that I think Icelanders feel about this. And I have to add that the women's team is also doing tremendously well and on the verge of making its World Cup. And so I think Icelanders are equally excited about that.
Okay. Are you all going to do the cheer for me? Or is that no?
Oh, come on. We can do it.
Okay, fine.
Are you ready?
3, 2, 1. Thank you. I wish this were television. We have another question from the audience. Go ahead.
Yes, my name is Jean Cobb, and I live in St. Agatha, Maine. And I noticed during the trip that got the sense that your crime rate is quite low, that you can feel pretty safe here. Maggie has mentioned it several times, and I asked a few questions. Have you seen, since the influx of tourism, any increase in your crime rate?
No.
I think, yeah, not significantly, no. And not that it can't be sort of, you know, you can pinpoint, oh, yeah, that's because of the tourism. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think so, really. And, more road tickets, that's the increased crime.
And that's just for us to, you know, pay for our medical bills at the end. So thank you for speeding. But what I think it's what I am very proud of, and I have experienced in my job as a guide, it hasn't been my main job, but for the past 2 years, that I see a lot of women traveling alone in Iceland. And I think that is a very good thing. And having my discussion with them, they say they not only because of the nature and the culture, they want to experience Iceland, but this is a perfect country for a woman to travel in Iceland alone in, because they're safe. So I think that's something that we should build on, most definitely.
Is there an effort when you're talking about planning for the future in tourism and of Iceland of attracting a certain kind of tourist? I know, for example, the Blue Lagoon is adding a luxury spa and resort, and adding the kind of tourist that can, has the capability of spending money. Somebody who comes in on a cheap Icelandic Air or WOW ticket that and brings their backpack and goes hiking in the backcountry probably doesn't add to the Icelandic economy like another tourist may.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, that's true. And that's one of the things that's been a big topic is how we're going to bring, you know, bring luxury tourism, bring tourists who spend more. But not only that, tourists who, not only like millionaires and wealthy people, just people who like to, you know, that what's also important is that people who, you know, are, you know, show respect to the nature and who go all around the country, like countries that are from countries that go more to the outskirts, because there's a vast difference between where nationalities go in Iceland. So that's...
So give me an example.
Example is that, you know, I don't have the exact number, but comparing, for instance, Germans and people from the UK, that's black and white. Germans come in the summer, they travel for long, they go all around the country. However, from the UK, generally, they come in the winters, come for a weekend, go see the Northern Lights, and then fly back home. So I think sort of overall that what people are aiming at is, yeah, of course, we want people to spend more, but it's not as simple as that.
It's
so we need people who want to go all around the country to...
I want to thank you all for being here. This has been a really interesting conversation. Before we go, though, I want to ask one final question. One thing I've noticed in the time I'm here is I feel, you know, this country is very, very different than Maine, that we don't have volcanoes and lava. We don't have steam coming out of the ground in Maine. But one thing I think is similar is the idea that these are places that have had a pretty hardscrabble history, but now are places that are full of art and design and music and sort of this modern energy. And I feel a similarity, at least between Reykjavik and Portland, Maine. And Oscar, you're nodding. Do you see the same similarity that I do?
Yeah, and I think the two things are related. I think a lot of Iceland's identity, its creativity, comes from its geography and its experiences. It hasn't been a difficult history over time, and now it's sort of a different chapter. And I'm sure in Maine, the same thing. And again, people come because of this very rugged landscape. So yeah, I think even though Maine is not technically an Arctic nation, I know Maine has made these inroads to Iceland and with the commonalities that both sides feel. So absolutely, I think that the relationship's only going to get closer.
Well, Oscar, Maggie, Conrad, thank you so much for taking time out of your day to be on Maine Calling. Special thank you to Martin and all of the crew here at RUV for hosting us in this terrific studio, and to our studio audience having a great time in Iceland today. If you would like to hear this program or any other Maine Calling program, you can go to our website, mainecalling.org. Maine Calling is produced by Cindy Hahn and Jonathan Smith. Tomorrow on the program, Coping with Maine's Real Estate Market. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.